That old time rock and roll. In honor of Captain Underpants, the first epic movie, what's the best cinematic undergarment?
I'm Katie Rich, and I'm kind of cheating, but it's the lack of an undershirt that Clark Gable wore in It Happened One Night, which, as story tells, made the sale of undershirts plummet from one very well-sculpted 1930s chest.
Hey, it's me, Dave with the Seven. What Jamie Lee Curtis is wearing in True Lies, and you know the scene that I'm talking about.
And I'm David Ehrlich, and I mean, I figured that this would be the most obvious answer, but even more so now that Dave baked it into the question. But Tom Cruise's button-down shirt and tidy whities in Risky Business.
The original Captain Underpants.
Yeah.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good, then. Well, then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine, then, and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's a podcast. Hello, and welcome to Fighting in the War Room, episode 168. It's Wednesday, May 31st, almost the end of May. And on this day in 1879, Madison Square Garden opened. And as far as I know, It was not the hellhole currently located above Penn Station.
Well, it was at least like three buildings ago. Madison Square Garden is more of an idea than it is a foundation. So,
how are the Rangers doing, David?
They're doing a lot better than they were in 1879. That's for sure. They're currently out of the playoffs because they were eliminated. But it's now the Stanley Cup Finals. But hey, we're only a few months away from the new season. So
there you go. It's always hope. So instead of reviews to read this week, David has a strongly worded message from for a very specific set of our listeners.
Yeah, this is for all of you people out there in New Zealand. What the fuck, mate?
Oh god.
That is a racial stereotype.
It's of a racial stereotype of a completely separate country. New Zealand. I love you. I've never been to you, but your exports are phenomenal. Less the Kiwis than the film locations. Sweeping vistas. They look beautiful. And you know what I love most of all about you? And not just the fact that you've exported Melanie Lynskey, a treasure, but also that you don't have any of the deadly spiders or snakes that make me so afraid to so much as set foot in one of Australia's airports on my way to your country. New Zealand, you seem like a lovely place. Peaceful, away from the chaos of our modern world, but still very civilized. I would love it if one or more of your people would do us the honor of leaving a review on the New Zealand iTunes store, which I just checked and found, to my horror, has zero reviews of Fighting in the War Room in our podcast's truly epic history. So please right this wrong. And perhaps if you leave us a nice enough, thoughtful enough review, one, or maybe all of us, one day will come down to Wellington or...
Oh my God, please.
What's the church something?
Christchurch?
Christchurch, yes. And we will thank you in person.
I think it's important to say that my full name is Catherine Rich, and that's, you know, I don't Google that name because I don't ever do anything under that name, but Catherine Rich... The most famous one was in the New Zealand House of Representatives until 2008. So, not my namesake, but we can say that she was.
If we could get Catherine Rich to leave us a review on Fighting in the War Room's iTunes store.
Oh, my God. She's now the head of the New Zealand Food and Grocery Council, which seems like a pretty busy job since there's a lot of food.
It seems like you'd have a lot of time to listen to podcasts.
This is a golden opportunity for you to be our marquee New Zealand listener, the person with whom we all associate New Zealand forever. So,
yeah,
please.
We'll call you New Zealand blank.
We will.
New Zealand Jane or New Zealand Tim.
And maybe when Thor the Dark World comes out, we can have you on as a New Zealand expert to explain Taika Waititi to us.
Thor Ragnarok, but
we
yes.
will absolutely
oh, damn it.
Have you on.
It is Thor Ragnarok. I'm sorry. You can come on and tell me the title of the proper Thor movie that I can't get right. New Zealand, step up. And all of you everywhere, step up. Give us a review.
Sure.
Just take those old records off the shelf. I'd sit and listen to them by myself. Today's music ain't got the same soul. I like that old
All right, David went to Cannes.
Yeah, David went to Cannes.
Hey, David, I heard you went to Cannes.
I did. I did go to Cannes. It all feels like a long lost dream.
So,
I feel like Daisy Gatsby reflecting on my... Not Daisy Gatsby, sorry. That is unfortunately not the name that she ever got that is for herself.
That's the fan fiction you read about? Yes. You're only for the Great Gatsby?
Exactly. That's in the version of the book that I cleaned up for young readers who didn't want to be troubled by ambiguous endings.
I heard you went for the first time because there was a Sofia Coppola movie and they couldn't keep you away. But why did you go to Cannes finally this year?
You hit the nail on the head. No, I had never gone to Cannes before for, well, a number of reasons, but the chief one of them being that it seemed very intimidating. It seemed like a lot of hassle, a lot of money, a lot of work, and just sort of off-putting to newcomers because of their very franche, very hierarchical system of press access with these sort of notoriously color-coded badges that are highly stratified access points and the horror stories that came out of that. And there's always this annual hubbub about who got what and what it means. And
did you not wear pink so that you could get a pink badge?
That's not precisely how the system works. It was more of like the secret sort of thing, like, you know, dress for the badge that you want within reason. I think the whiteness of my skin, by virtue of that logic, would have earned me the white badge, which is the best of all badges, but I settled for pink, which was just fine for my purposes. I finally went because I work at a job where they, to be perfectly honest, took care of a lot of my anxiety about navigating the ropes of Cannes. I mean, it was arranged for me where I was staying, and I was getting there, and so on. And I was with a great group of people who could show me the ropes. And it was as good as advertised, I have to say. It was worth the wait. There was a little bit of like a pleasure delaying thing about the whole idea of going, because it's really the top of the mountain. It's sort of the Valhalla of film festivals. And once you go there, it's really nowhere else to go. I guess you could move up the ranks of Cannes and so on. But
Get that white badge.
It really felt like many years in the making, a journey many years in the making. And it was a hell of a time. I published today an article on IndieWire that gives you a little bit more of an on-the-ground perspective of my experience there as a Cannes virgin, the things that I saw, the reality versus expectations, and so on. But I suspect that most people listening to this and most people I'm talking to now, all two of them, are probably more interested about the movies or not. I don't know. I'm here for you, whatever you want.
I don't know. Dave, what do you want to know about Cannes?
Well, I'm very interested in this year's sort of what seemed like externally a battle over the line between television and theatrical releases. And I know we sort of touched on it in an earlier episode, but having come back, how do you feel about both television at Cannes and specifically Netflix and competition films?
It was a thing, let me tell you. It started long before the festival with things that we've talked about in previous episodes of this podcast regarding French laws of the time between when something premieres in theaters and when it can appear on streaming services and so on, and Cannes granting Okja and the Meyerowitz stories, the Noah Baumbach film, competition slots, and then sort of right before the festival saying that will never happen again. It was Vic Bruaha and Pedro Almodovar, who was the head of the jury, was asked during the opening press conference, which always seems to result in some sort of controversy. And Cannes loves their controversy. They welcome it. I mean, they gave us badges, or pins rather, when we got there that have all sort of like self-denigrating slogans on them. They really seem to embrace their history of ruffling feathers. And they recognize that they are the world's most important festival, and they run with that. But Pedro Almodovar said in the opening press conference in something that was sort of maybe almost definitely mistranslated, that they wouldn't consider a film that wasn't going to play in theaters for the Palme d'Or. And I think what he was trying to say was that he couldn't really conceive of a world sort of similar to my sentiment, that where the movie that won the most prestigious prize in all of film, an award that really makes the Oscar look like the piece of shit that it is. I can't even tell you, Katie, how much more fun it is. Have you been to Cannes, Katie?
I have not been to Cannes.
How much more fun it is to obsess over what's going to win the Palme d'Or than it is to go through the 6 month slog of picking the Oscars. But
I love it. More Oscars.
I know, but you would really get off, I think, on the hyper concentrated, completely speculative sense of picking the Palme d'Or, guessing what it might be, because it feels like every single person at the festival is on this sort of mass jury, and they have the grids at the end of every day in Screen International. You can see what the movies are ranking, and everyone is thinking, what did Will Smith like? What was Will Smith's reaction to the new Hong Sang-soo movie? Everything this year just went back to Will Smith. It was on.
Don't you think that usually about how Will Smith is relating to like the new Hanukkah?
I mean, what a jury this was. It was Pedro Almodovar was the president. He gets two votes. But it was Fan Bing Bing and Jessica Chastain, who is great and I thought was is someone that I would pick for any jury. And Will Smith and Maren Ade, who directed Tony Erdmann, Park Chan-wook, and more. I mean, more very famous and recognizable names that are slipping my mind right now.
Wait. That sounded like the voice of somebody who hung out with Jessica Chastain a little bit.
No, I wish. Please. You think I would have any modesty about telling you I hung out with Jessica Chastain?
Well, I was going to commiserate and squeeze all the details out of you and tell you not to wash your hands so I could scrape your palm for DNA.
She was on my flight on the way over.
Dave, you hung out in her trailer with her three-legged dog.
I've hung out with Jessica Chastain three times, and it has all been fantastic.
Well,
podcast. Yeah,
you should be leading that segment. I was on her flight and milling around the baggage claim with her, and when you walk out of baggage claim, which seems so calm, you are greeted by like a human funnel of paparazzi who could not care less about you, but
Erlich?
Had definitely been tipped off that Jessica Chastain was there, but they're so tightly packed. And it goes from being this huge open baggage claim room to sort of like a World War Z with a tiny little tunnel that you can escape through. It's very bizarre. But anyway, Pedro Almodovar was saying that, mistranslated as saying that he wouldn't give the award to a Netflix film. And I think that's not what he was intending to say, not what he did say. But it started the festival off on a very interesting note. And then at the Oakja premiere screening at 8:30 in the morning on like the third day of Cannes at the Grand Lumiere Theater, the Netflix logo comes up. There are huge boos. Cannes is a big booing and applause town. And this is something that I really grew to enjoy at the festival, even if I did not participate in it. But as I wrote about in my IndieWire piece today, it really feels like everyone is there to battle for the future of film, for the soul of the art form. It is something worth fighting for. And that is a really wonderful sort of spirit to have, but they fucked up the screening. There was a masking problem in the projection. The top half of everyone's head on screen was being cut off, and it would be an understatement to say that the largely French, but it really, you know, international audience in that room that morning, already boisterous, already booing at logos, was taking this lying down. It was not violent, but it was very intense. And it was hard to know what was going to happen if they didn't shut off the movie, which they did after 10 minutes, and they fixed it, and life went on. And then Cannes, having appreciated seeing a movie that I think to many people's mind was strong, applauded at the end of the movie. So, you know, the movies really do come first. But yeah, that was a big story there. And the very, very best thing that I saw at Cannes this year, and this is perverse, given that it was my first Cannes Film Festival, and I have certain positions on all these things, was a television show. It's a television show directed by a Palme d'Or winner, and that still leaves you two choices from this year's lineup. But it probably wasn't the one you're thinking of, because I did not see Twin Peaks at Cannes.
Was it good?
What?
Was Top of the Lake good, since that's what we're guessing you saw?
Yes, Top of the Lake was by far the best thing I saw at Cannes. I saw all 6 hours of the new season. If you haven't seen the first season of Top of the Lake, it is almost mandatory to enjoy the second one. I'm not going to say absolutely mandatory, but almost mandatory. But it's also brilliant, and you have until September to watch it. So what are you doing? It's 6 episodes. You can do it. The second season, more Elizabeth Moss, more Jane Campion. Gwendolyn Christie, Dave, for all your Game of Thrones people out there, she has more screen time in this than I think she probably does cumulatively in the rest of her career, and she is absolutely brilliant. Her chemistry with Elizabeth Moss is incredible, and
yes. The way that are they buddy cops?
that, well, it's very, yeah, but it's very, very, very complicated. She, Gwendolyn Christie is introduced at first as sort of this bumbling comic relief, and the way that her character grows over the subsequent five episodes, is pretty remarkable. I was knocked sideways by this season of television, and I really hope that more festivals like TIFF show it all on the big screen, because when you're seeing something on the big screen, its ultimate destination matters a hell of a lot less. Big screen is sort of a great equalizer. But, and so that was a little bit of cognitive dissonance for me, flying all the way there in the mecca of film and my clear favorite of the festival being a television show. I also thought that Okja and the Meyerowitz stories were both two of the stronger entries in the competition.
Wait, talk about the Meyerowitz stories a little bit, because I feel like there's a lot going on at Cannes, but that the fact that movie is an Adam Sandler movie that is premiering on Netflix, which has shown a lot of right. Adam Sandler garbage, as Matt Patches has talk about cognitive dissonance. I'm having a hard time with this one.
Yeah, I mean, it turns out that writers and directors matter when it comes to art, and not all Adam Sandler movies are created equally. This is something we've known for a long time, something that Paul Thomas Anderson has tapped into in the past, something that even Judd Apatow was tapped into in the past. And here you have an Adam Sandler movie that he stars in a large cast. He is probably the lead actor in the film, but it is a large cast, a cast that includes Ben Stiller and Dustin Hoffman and Emma Thompson and Grace Van Patten, who's so great in Tramps, which is another Netflix movie. And it's a Noah Baumbach movie. It's written and directed by Noah Baumbach. It's about a artistically inclined family of New York Jews who are struggling with the lack of success of the patriarch, Slipper Dustin Hoffman, and the effect that his divorce from many years earlier has had on his children. And it's,
wait. Yeah. So it's a Jewish Royal Tenenbaums?
Oh, yeah. It is such a Jewish Royal Tenenbaums. But it's exactly that. I scrawled the words, the Royal Tenenbaums, in large block letters in my notes while I was watching it.
I can't imagine why you would like this, David.
Yes, I related very strongly to it, and it's not my favorite Noah Baumbach movie. My favorite Noah Baumbach movie is probably the one that I sort of explicitly relate to least, which is Mistress America. But it's a good movie. But overall, I'd say the stories that overshadowed this stuff at Cannes, which is really a marathon. There's plenty of time for one story to overtake another. The major unifying theme for me seemed to be the refugee crisis, which I think we really got a glimpse of is going to dominate European cinema for the foreseeable future. You could find traces of it in everything from Michael Haneke's The Happy End to Andrei Zvyagintsev's Loveless to Jupiter's Moon, which is sort of like a bone dumb version of Children of Men directed by the guy who made White God. But it's shot beautifully. I mean, it's tracking shots are to die for. And Vanessa Redgrave made a film that's less of a documentary than it is just a PSA, imploring British policymakers to open their eyes to the reality of the refugee crisis. It's called Sea Sorrow. It is not, I would hesitate to even qualify it as art, but, as an infomercial for basic decency, it is striking. Yeah, I mean, just to wrap up the segment, if we're at that point, although I am happy to field any other questions you have about the Cannes experience, it was a wild ride. Some of the other movies I saw, I mean, I'm totally in the tank, as anyone who's listened to this show for a while could imagine, for Sofia Coppola's The Beguiled, which is going to be opening here pretty soon. I was thrilled that she won Best Director, and I think it's entirely well-earned. It was bowled over by, I mean, such a warm, touching, life-affirming, bittersweet movie is Agnès Varda's and J.R.'s Faces, Places, or Visages, Villages, which is sort of like The Trip, or The Trip to Italy, or The Trip to Spain, but with semi-documentary and with Agnès Varda and like a 33-year-old street artist, and it is delightful. Sean Baker's The Florida Project, which Sean Baker made Tangerine. This is, I think, even a step up from Tangerine, which I loved. And it is not shot in quite the same style. It's beautiful, 35mm, as opposed to being shot on iPhones. But it is about the residents, the invisible homeless, so to speak, of the Magic Kingdom Motel, which is this really, really, really sad place right in the shadow of Disney World. And it's just about some of the kids that live there and their mother. And Willem Dafoe plays the proprietor, or not the proprietor, but the sort of handyman around the motel. He gives one of the best performances of his career. It's a really thrilling movie. I liked Todd Haynes' Wonderstruck. And Lynn Ramsey was finishing her movie. And every year at Cannes, it sounds from afar. And now I've experienced firsthand, like, one of the filmmakers, you hear all sorts of rumors that they are editing up until the last minute. That was the case with Lynn Ramsey this year, who wasn't quite doing the Wong Kar-wai, like, bringing the movie to the theater one reel at a time as the celluloid was drying. But she finished it, I think, the day before, or 2 days before, because there was a screening before the official press screening. It's called You Were Never Really Here. Lynn Ramsey, who made Ratcatcher, Morven Caller, we need to talk about Kevin. It stars Joaquin Phoenix as a, it's really unclear, but it's like kind of a hitman. Like imagine like a super, super elliptical modernist Leon the Professional starring a weirdly pudgy Joaquin Phoenix who's like flabby down the middle but with giant arms.
Isn't he always weirdly pudgy in some way? Like, even
I don't know. His body here
I don't want to body shame Joaquin Phoenix.
This is not body shame at all, but it's the kind of body that doesn't happen by accident. It's a really interesting look. This movie, which sort of bizarrely won Best Screenplay, and I thought would have been a more worthwhile candidate for something like Best Director.
Didn't he win Best Actor too?
He did win Best Actor, yeah. Screenplay can't, of course, doesn't just mean the dialogue. There are maybe like 12 words and All of You Were Never Really Here. This is really an editor and director's movie. I mean, it's like really a bonsai of a film. I mean, there's so much cut out of it to get to this 85-minute elliptical thing of negative space, negative action. There are no action scenes in the movie. It's all aftermath. It's all inference. It's very, very bleak and heavy, and Johnny Greenwood layers it all with an incredible score. And it was the last film that screened in competition. It was a real doozy. That was Cannes. I had a great time. I think that's the problem with any of these festivals. Once you go, you can't really stomach the idea of not being there the next year or any of the years to come. I hope to be
You've
back.
You've been ruined.
I have.
Loose. Canon. Evangelist. Space waster. Get the over here. And hush, child. Don't make me ape.
So guys, last weekend I went down to Santa Fe to meet up with some of my friends from college in honor of our 10-year anniversary from graduating. So we're all feeling old.
You didn't do your 10-year reunion, to be clear, so you went to Santa Fe.
Yeah, if there was a 10-year reunion, I don't know who would have organized that. They certainly did not get in contact with me. This was a completely independent thing. But
I
in honor
my 10-year
of,
reunion, it was great.
Oh, hey.
Different college.
Questions also for later. one thing I did end up doing in Santa Fe that nobody told me what it was until I showed up there, and then I participated in it, and I was like, holy shit, why has nobody told me anything about this? So I figured I'd come and at least enlighten you guys to its existence. It's called Meow Wolf. It's a artist collective that was doing art around Santa Fe, and then their founders happened to meet George R. R. Martin, who's a big supporter of Santa Fe, lives in the area, and started talking, and George R. R. Martin ended up buying a old bowling alley and allowing them to renovate it into an art space. And what they've put into this art space I think it's called the House of Eternal Being. It's a singular show where you enter in and there's a Victorian style home, and you open the mailbox and there's a letter for an agent and there's some condolence cards, and then how you interact with the space is sort of up to you. They're supposed to take like 2 hours, they say, minimum. I spent a good 40 minutes reading through different newspapers and journals and computer files in the house. But as you're sort of moving through the space, you notice that certain things are like warped. Like it looks like some of the plaster in the wall became liquid for a brief period of time, or the toilet is at a weird angle. And if you look down into it, you see a child disappearing.
Whoa.
Down into the toilet.
Whoa, yeah. What? Hang on, twist.
I know. No, that's how it's slowly these things are really weird. And then I turned around and saw somebody just walk into the fridge and not come out. And so I was like, hey, maybe instead of trying to figure out this entire story, we should just maybe just do like that guy did and walk into the fridge. I didn't realize that the house is the center point that has all these like story points, but you don't really need to do it. The majority of Meow Wolf is the people who lived in the house ended up opening up portals to other dimensions. And there are all these different art spaces modeled after different dimensions. And some of them are interactive. Some of them have performers. Some of them are just really well hidden, so you kind of have to discover them by, like, it's one of the only art spaces I've been to where you're encouraged to open any door or crawl into any nook that doesn't have a sign that says employees only. So, like, even if it's a painted black door or if it's a door that looks like it's, you know, molded in for some sort of maintenance, you'd, like, open it and it'd be a room full of giant robotic hands you could control would, like, be pinching at you.
But did you do Sleep No More in New York, Dave?
I did do Sleep No More.
So how does this compare?
This is less narrative, I think, is actually better. There's a way you could, I think, your first time through Meow Wolf, pick up the idea that there is a master narrative, but a lot of the master narrative also exists online, so you could interact with it without being in the space. I think once you get a vague idea, interacting with the space is going to end up being much cooler than trying to follow a narrative. Whereas I feel like Sleep No More gets rewarding as a narrative and exploration. I think Meow Wolf, much more exploring based. Like the night that we were there, about halfway through our experience, one of the rooms got closed off for an electronica show that was going to happen until 2 a.m. And then inside also one of the spaces is a arcade, and the arcade does have something to do with the Arch story, but also all the games in the arcade are free. There's lots of places that are just like hangout places. Like basically you walk in and you're like, this is a good place to be high and enjoy art, or be a teenager and need somewhere to make out that no one's going to find you or care.
And either one is okay.
And either one seems to be okay. There weren't a lot of rules outside of like, you know, don't physically assault the actors. Everything's very tactile. If you know, like if you touch a mushroom, it might play a musical note. There's a like a weird laser show that ends up being a light harp. So if you pluck the lasers, it starts playing music. There is an overall story and everything, but I wasn't expecting like an art experience to surprise me with both a story layer and such a, I don't know, experiential layer at the same time. And then right in the middle of Santa Fe, who knew? Why did nobody tell me about Meow Wolf? I encourage you all to Google it. I don't think there's going to be anything ruined by seeing the videos. It's not like they have a full walkthrough of the plot, but just so you have a vague idea of what I'm talking about, it is crazy. Real life theater. Dig it.
I just Googled it. It really sounds pretty amazing.
Yeah, I recommend it. Next time you guys are in Santa Fe.
Yeah, I go to Santa Fe all the time. Wait, so you went to Santa Fe and Albuquerque?
I feel like the segment ended, but yes.
I know I did. I'm just curious.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, I went to Albuquerque. I flew into Albuquerque because flying into Santa Fe is like twice as expensive because the airport's tiny.
Huh. Do I know, like, where even are they in relation to each other?
They're like 59 minutes drive.
Oh.
On a highway.
I used to assume everything out west is like really far apart.
Well, it is far apart, but there's a highway.
So now we're going to welcome Christy Puchko, who is a host of Popcorn and Prosecco and a writer for, I feel like I'm not even going to list all the places. Christy, you're all over the internet. Where are some good places you should list?
Yeah, I write most frequently at Nerdist and Pajiba and Comic Book Resources.
And you reviewed Wonder Woman, which is a movie we want to talk about for Comic Book Resources, I believe.
I did, yeah. It was exciting. It was my first, like, absolutely positive review for a DCEU movie, which was really exciting because I've gotten a lot of, let's say, hassle for not fully... And I wrote a pretty positive Suicide Squad review.
Which really sets you apart from
everyone else. Do you regret that at all?
I mean, only because people were still such jerks about it. Like, I don't think... I said in my review for Suicide Squad, I didn't think it was a good movie, but I thought it was fun, which was more than I could say for Man of Steel or BVS. So, like, partial credit.
which is what all we're willing to give DCEU movies, basically. I want to get into the insanity of DC fans, but so we wanted you on here both because you have excellent opinions on many things and because you've seen Wonder Woman, which none of us currently talking actually have. And you wrote such a wonderful, glowing review, and it's one of the ones that makes me really excited to see it. So just real quick, it being the best DC movie, as you've said, is kind of faint praise coming from you, but why is it really special beyond that?
Well, I think part of it is that, and this isn't just a DC thing, because Marvel's been doing this too. A lot of the superhero movies lately are so brooding over the idea of, like, oh, heavy is the head that wears the cape and all that shit. And I'm just tired of it. I guess cowl would be a better metaphor there.
But if, like, you're wearing a cape on your head, you're really...
Listen, really, I would not put it past DC movies.
Heavy is the head that wears the depression beard. But, like... It's just this thing where it's like, I don't know, I want to go to a superhero movie for escapism, and so many of the movies lately have just been like, and another thing that's tough about being a superhero. It's just like, oh, okay. But, like, Wonder Woman, we saw it a little bit in Batman vs. Superman, where Gal Gadot played the role of Wonder Woman with this, like, smile and this verve and this, like, excitement about who she is. And that was so, such a relief and such a breath of fresh air in that movie that was so dour and so... It was Batman and Superman versus each other, and yet it was just so bleak.
Their moms are both named Martha.
Yeah, well, thank for that, because otherwise, where would we be?
Where would we be?
But in this movie, like, there's a real warmth that she has, and not just that, but, like, a sense of, you know, pardon the pun, but wonder about the world, not just the world of man, but just everything. And she's basically, it's, I mean, like, it's funny because I remember when the early images came out, people were comparing it to Little Mermaid because, yes, shot for shot, the scene on the beach is the Little Mermaid where she rescues Eric. Totally. But it is that movie. It's the idea of, like, someone who lives in a fantastical realm being brought to the world of man and finding it fascinating. And I think the way
the world of the world of man, really, Christy?
I mean, in both senses, in both instances, in Little Mermaid, I wish I thought of this for comparison for my review, but yeah, Little Mermaid. I mean, it's that thing. And I just thought it was so much fun. It was so unexpected. And, like, the sense of levity that they are able to weave, and it's not a light movie. I mean, it happens in World War I. There's a lot of carnage and death and sadness, but because they have the levity, you remember what she's fighting for. And I think that, you know, we can all relate to when things look really dark, you need somebody to remind you of the light and of what's worth fighting for.
The fact that it's set in World War I, I think, is really interesting. It kind of sets the whole thing, like, visually apart from the rest of it. Like, do you feel like it kind of, how does it fit into everything else that DC is doing by having this, like, period piece? As
well, right, and also, you know, to piggyback off that question, it's a prequel, so I think I would imagine, and Christy, I leave this to you to answer, that it has less cumbersome legwork to do because we already sort of, in the long run, know where it's going. So I would hope that it would be free to be its own thing.
Sort of. We don't, like, in Batman versus Superman, we don't know a lot about Diana Prince, and she, like, Gal Gadot has this kind of cool confidence in that movie, and she seems to think they're very silly for fighting, and she seems to understand that, you know, things aren't all good or all bad. And this is really the movie where she learns that lesson, because at the beginning of the movie, she's been raised on myths of heroes and villains, and she doesn't, you know, she doesn't really have any kind of gray area in the way she thinks. And this is the journey of learning that gray area. But it's not like that prequel thing where you know where everything's going, except for the fact that they put this bookend device on it. So it starts with, like, the Diana we know and her getting that picture that they have at the end of BVS where Bruce is like, what's your deal? Here's a photo of you from World War One. And, like, you know, it bookends the film. It's a pretty superficial connection. What works is that Patty Jenkins and Gal Gadot and the screenwriters came up with a way to figure out how she gets from this excited girl on, how do you pronounce the name of the island? Themyscira?
That sounds correct to me.
I think so. To the woman we meet in BVS. And I actually thought that the transition of it was really beautifully done. I forget what else you were asking me.
I think you answered it pretty well. How it sort of stands apart. Katie was asking how it stands apart from aesthetically from the other.
Aesthetically, it's interesting because it's kind of a film in three movements without getting super into spoilers. The first act takes place in Themyscira, which looks nothing like anything we've seen in DC movies. And it's just exciting the way they've created the Amazons. And Robin Wright she was born to play an Amazon. It's so good.
She's basically been doing it on House of Cards for years with no
credit. And it's like to actually see the whole armor and everything, you're like, you know, it's even, what was that movie? The Congress, where like she like sort of plays a superhero in like the fantasy sequences it's like she's been waiting for this moment and she just grabs it by the horns and she's so much fun to watch. And then it's like the second section is when they're in London, which is with the stuff you see in the trailers where they're like joking about what she has to wear and like you can't carry a sword with that outfit, and it feels like a different movie. And then they go to the battlefront and it's a different movie again. And it's the kind of thing that I think some people will find jarring, but I personally really enjoyed because it felt like a journey. It didn't feel like, you know, I don't know, getting lost in Gotham/Metropolis, where it's like, where even are we? Because everything looks the same. Like the film has three distinct visual looks. And for me, I thought it made the 2 hours and 20 minutes go by very effectively because it felt like, I guess it felt less like a movie and more like watching a miniseries, which I love a miniseries. So I was fine with that.
That's an interesting, I don't know how to take that because 2 hours and 20 minutes. I don't know if that's.
I'm with you. Normally, when people are like, "It's over 2 hours," I'm like, "Oh."
No, it's not that it sounds too long. It's the fact that it's like a miniseries. Where here I am hoping that these superhero movies have more of a sort of coherent, typically filmic narrative arc, as opposed to trying to do all these various things and set up X and Y and still feel incredibly formulaic. But I don't know. I know that you mean that it's a positive, but it sounds altogether like it's a movie that was made by someone who had seen Batman v Superman and maybe learn from some of its mistakes.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I know that they're sticking to some things from the comics, and I know they're trying to keep it in keeping with the world. So you do have a little bit of the muted color tones, but I think the film more reflects who Wonder Woman is and who Diana is. So you get more vibrant colors, you get a lighter sense of humor. And what I really liked is the comedy's never about her. In my review for CBR, I compared it to Thor. We're not laughing at Thor. We're kind of laughing at Thor in our world. Where, like, you know, there's, like, an instance where they make her go, like, get clothes that are appropriate for a woman of the time in London. And she's just so exasperated with the fashions. And it's funny, but it's not that we're laughing at her. It's like, that is a completely irrational outfit to go to war in.
Mm-hmm. You're reminding me how much I love the first Thor where he drinks the coffee in the diner, and then I don't remember what he screams, but he like slams the coffee cup.
I think it's just another. It's like that idea where it's like, of course, this is what happens when you bring, you know, an Amazonian god into London.
Now, do you have any reason to believe, based on the evidence, that the DCEU will build off of this momentum and actually grow a warmer, more inviting place for all of these characters? Or
I'm
if it's going
to
be
that all
like
the movies have to be like Wonder Woman, but like I felt like Man of Steel and Batman versus Superman were treating the property so sternly that it cut off a lot of the fandom who was like, look, I love a Batman movie, but let's be honest, he's a dude in a bat suit who's fighting crime because his parents are dead. It's so weird. Like, just, you know, my favorite Batman is Batman Returns, so take that with what you will. But I like the sense of kind of ludicrousness that is to me inherent in those kind of properties. And I think Wonder Woman recognizes that in a way that makes sense. But I don't think that, like, all of a sudden Zack Snyder's going to turn around and be like, oh, everything needs to have more levity. I mean, he's been pretty stalwartly against that, it seems. But, I mean, like, you have Joss Whedon coming to the franchise, sort of. Like, I think Batgirl's not going to be continuous, right? It's going to be its own thing.
As far as we know.
Oh, yeah. I forgot about that. I thought you meant in the more unfortunate circumstances under which he is taking some control over Justice League.
I think in Justice League, Joss Whedon's probably going to try to be just the guiding hand to create the movie Zack started making. I don't think he's going to try to do anything too radical to it because out of respect for the filmmaker and all that kind of stuff. I do hope that they took notes because I do think that Wonder Woman was shaped under the shadow of BVS where they said, okay, people didn't like this stuff. They liked Wonder Woman. What did they like about Wonder Woman? They liked that she smiled during the battle scene. And I know that sounds like a dumb thing, like such a small thing to base a character on, but they got it. They understood like that Wonder Woman enjoys being who she is. She enjoys being a superhero. And that was enough of a jump off point that the film feels different than the others.
That smile during the battle scene, like I, you know, my memories of Batman versus Superman are kind of fuzzy because what do you even take out of that movie? But the way that she like enjoyed wielding that golden lasso, like that was the moment of Batman versus Superman where it was like, oh, someone's making this movie. Like there's a human behind this whole thing. Right. So the fact that they kind of
bar has been set.
And at that point in the movie, you're just like anything for a real feeling. And the idea that Wonder Woman recognizes that, I mean, it's what the Marvel movies have done to some extent, and DC having its own version of that, it's like maybe the best thing they could do for themselves at this point.
Right, because even in Suicide Squad, now Suicide Squad had a little more humor, but the characters were all still reluctant heroes. So it still had this slight drudgery to it. We're like, I guess we got to save the day. And like Wonder Woman's not like that. She's there to save the day. It's all she wants to do. And what's really fun is that they managed to put in characters who don't feel like attachments or like the sidekick you have so that you can sell them as an action figure. Like Chris Pine as Steve Trevor is actually really wonderful. And I was initially groaning when they announced that Steve Trevor was going to be a thing because it was like, ugh, can't we just have a Wonder Woman movie? Does she have to have a love interest? And I was totally on that boat. I have gotten off that boat because they're great together. It's actually, comparing it to Thor, and I know not everyone loves Thor and Jane together, but it's that dynamic where he is an above average, very capable person. He is smart and all this. He's just not a superhero. So, like, it's a good entry point for the audience and also a good way to, like, have her introduced to things that she doesn't understand, but not in a way that's condescending, just in a way that's, like, you know, as if we come from different cultures and this is how things work where I live. And, but most of all, just they're so fucking charming together. It's crazy. And he's so funny with the way he's able to like turn, like, I feel like in the hands of a lesser actor, Steve Trevor would come off, you know, blansome and annoying. And you would just be like, can we get less
blansome? Blansome. Oh, wow. How I dream of being called blansome one day.
Wait. Okay. So David, you're a man.
I mean, medically speaking.
Does the presence of Chris Pine make it feel like it's okay for you to see this movie? Or is it just so clear to you that this movie is only for women and you've been banned from all the screenings, as far as I understand Twitter? I mean, do you feel comfortable seeing Wonder Woman now?
I don't really even know how to begin to answer that.
I kind of set you up. I'm sorry.
Defend your gender. Go.
So malformed beyond the idea of seeing a movie of this size as being a choice. So like it's just so obligatory. But yes, I believe that I would feel extremely comfortable. Also, for what it's worth, something that's interesting about Gal Gadot or Gadot or whatever the fuck is that she is what I like to call a Jew. And that is very meaningful to me because, you know, it's not as, well, to some people, at least it's not, you know, as urgent a representation issue as putting a woman front and center and having to be a superhero. And of course, but there is an extra measure of satisfaction for me that so many of the most virulent haters of all kinds out there really like to just spread the love around. And it's not just, you know, women is where it begins, but I think a lot of those people, you would not be surprised, who are protesting all female screenings or against the idea of a Wonder Woman movie to begin with, probably don't have the nicest thing to say about the Jews either.
So you're basically saying that you think there's a crossover between misogyny and anti-Semitism in this reaction.
I think that there can be.
Thanks,
not, they're not exclusive. I think that I love the fact that Gal Gadot sort of checks two boxes, one of which
is your tribe.
Is mine. And Superman is Jewish. And that's, but, you know.
Well,
so.
But Zack Snyder's making him Christ. I want to say this. I'm very happy.
Christ was a Jew.
What was Christ?
Christ was a Jew. It's
fair,
true.
Fair enough.
Go ahead, Dave.
I'm happy that there is this, you know, gross group of Manda making themselves visible because for a while I didn't know how much of the DC EU fandom to paint with these are just idiots brush. Because, you know, I don't want to tell people what they can and can't like. You know, I just give my opinion of things like Batman v Superman is a bad movie. And eventually, you know, some people would come back with not completely stupid arguments that would come down to things that I don't necessarily agree with, but I can't prove wrong because it's a feeling. But then if they come along and they're like, and Wonder Woman only screenings or women only screenings of Wonder Woman is like somehow a violation of civil rights, I'm like, oh, you were just an idiot all along. I can move on.
Right, but here's my question, and specific to Christy, but really to the whole panel. You know, the outsized reaction that you get whenever you, I mean, these events, these like female only screenings, and you know, they're going to have other things for other movies, or lightning rods for the lowest common denominator, the worst of our species, certainly the worst of our culture. Do they serve as, I mean, clearly this is not to take away from the fact that there are major imbalances in representation and certainly, you know, behind the camera as much as in front of the camera. But do these sort of straw men help bolster the need for representation, or does it feel like a victory over such a small but virulently outspoken group of the community that we're not necessarily making progress so much as we are enticing the worst among us to embarrass themselves?
I mean, I don't think punching down is bad in this case, but I'm sorry.
I'm not Christy, saying it's bad. It's a devil's advocate question.
No, go ahead.
I'm just saying that.
Well, I mean, I think. The level that we're talking about it, we're, you know, in conversations about it with idiots on Twitter or writing about reactions to, you know, different weird screenings. I think what Wonder Woman's ultimately going to be important for is for whoever decides it's a movie for them, completely independent of some sort of brand fidelity or certainly independent of the almost not their marketing scheme. The fact that Wonder Woman is so anticipated and is tracking as well is an indication of how much people want this movie. I think to a certain degree, if we want to take this PR cycle and bring some assholes to the forefront so we can knock them down, the importance of Wonder Woman is going to be decided later. So I say let's go bowling with assholes.
Bowling with assholes. If this were Pod Save America, that's the point of the episode where I would say there's our title.
Christy, I wanted to talk to you specifically because I think you've been more tuned into this than I have about the stakes that were involved in something like this. Because if Wonder Woman had sucked, it just feels like it would have been this blow of superhero movies and movies directed by women. Like there were so many different things that needed to go right with this. Like how nervous were you going into this for it to go right? And what kind of relief have you felt this week where the reviews have been good? The tracking is good. It looks like it's going to make money. Like it's like we've cleared this hurdle that for me, I wasn't even aware I had so much writing on until it happened.
Yeah, I think I tried to block a lot of it out in advance to it, though. I did admit to Angie Han, a friend of mine who writes for Mashable. She and I were talking about it and about like before we had seen the movie going like, fuck, I hope I like this movie. Cause it just like what sucked is like it was like Ghostbusters last year or The Heat before that, where it doesn't get to just be a summer movie. It has to be the woman summer movie. And so like if you're the woman that didn't super love it, you're gonna get shit. If you're the girl that super loved it, you're gonna get shit, but at least for something you liked. So I guess that's something. And like, you know, there have been all these worrisome signs. There were some early rumors about things. There was the fact that the marketing didn't seem to know what the fuck it was doing. And is like, women like diet bars, right? Let's advertise the movie on diet bars. Like,
did they do that?
Oh, that's a real thing. We wrote about it on the Jibe.
Oh, man. Oh.
It's like Think Slim or something like that. But like, you know, there was all these miscalculations that were worrisome. And like Patty Jenkins is a bit of an unknown entity because she's done so much TV. And that's kind of harder to peg down in a sense of auteurship, which is not to say that she's not a good director. It's just harder to make sense of like, what was she going to do with this property? And then Wonder Woman herself has so many incarnations. What were they going to do? And then the DCU doesn't seem to make much sense with women. And like, there were so many things that I was just trying not to think about because in our jobs, I try not to go in with like tons of stuff on my mind about the movie, which is sometimes unavoidable, but I was trying to just kind of be like, let's just experience this. Let's see what happens and be open to it or whatever. And I didn't realize how much this movie meant to me personally until the scene where she finally goes onto the battlefield in like full Wonder Woman regalia. And I just started crying. And it was just, she looked glorious. And I realized that like, I've spent so much of my life like waiting for moments like that for girls, because like, and I mentioned before in this episode, Batman Returns, I don't think that's a coincidence. Like for me, Catwoman was huge, like just hugely formative for me, because even though she wasn't totally a hero, she stood up for herself. She refused to play by guys' rules. Like these, all the men in that movie, all these stupid rules about how she should behave. And every single one of them, she's like, fuck you, I do what I want. And
you're not talking about the Pitoff film Catwoman, correct? But rather the character.
I'm talking about Michelle Pfeiffer as Catwoman all day. But like that meant a lot to me. And what's cool about Wonder Woman is like, she doesn't even have to have the anger that Catwoman had. She can just exist on her own terms. And, you know, I think there's a lot weighing on this, and it's like, I'm nervous even to talk about it because not all the reviews are in. And I do think that because the critics that saw the film first, me included, our reviews have been so effusive and so excited. I think there will be a bit of a snapback because now the expectation is high because people tend to not understand how Rotten Tomatoes works.
And this always happens regardless of Wonder Woman or women or whatever. Like, well, this is a common phenomenon.
We're going to have an Armand White who's going to fuck up the soup, whatever. So that's going to happen. But the thing is that I think it is getting well received. I don't think it's the best superhero movie in the past decade, but I think it's one of the better ones. And I say that not because it's a female movie, but because it was genuinely moving and exciting, and I'm eager to go see it again. I've already bought my tickets for this weekend, because my husband hasn't gotten to go and I want an excuse to go again. So everybody wins. But yeah, it does weigh on us, because if this movie had failed, even if it was disappointing, you would have all these studios going, see, like, women can't carry superhero movies. And see, female directors just don't get action. And like, the action in this is good. So it's going to be, what sucks is that's not going to change everything either. This is not going to be the tipping point where all of a sudden people are like, oh, well then women directors for action movies. Like you're still going to have to people like women that are going to have to battle their asses off just to get into those conversations.
Right. But the measuring stick for success will be when you can have a female driven superhero movie fail and not have it at all impact the culture and, you know, the assembly line of what's coming down the pike. Rather than, you know, something like Get Out being a measuring stick for all black movies and so on. I mean, it's that is one of the main sources of disequilibrium in, I think, the Hollywood pipeline. But
totally. I mean, by contrast, one of our writers at Pajiba wrote a piece about when King Arthur failed, saying, so like, now we know that white directors need to stop being a thing, right? Because look at all these movies. And it was like he did a list of the movies that have lost like the most money. And I think 9 out of 10 were white directors.
And I'm surprised it wasn't 10 out of 10 just because there's so many white directors. It might have been
10 out of 10. I'm trying to be kind, but I forget what some of them were. But it was, you know, it was like Cutthroat Island and Lone Ranger and King Arthur and like all these movies that tanked super hard, directed by white dudes, which again is a numbers game. But that doesn't mean that people don't, you know, people play that card the opposite way all the time.
Well, to segue to our Cannes coverage, where there was so much controversy about, and deservedly so, about only 3 of the films in competition being directed by people without penises. We'll see how that turned out.
I just want to point out that's not a solid definition of a woman.
No.
Yeah. God, David. Well, come on. You were so woke for so long and you fucked it up.
The right thing.
I like it. You know, it's worth it for the alliteration, I have to say.
Well, Dave, we're going to talk about Wonder Woman again next week once more of us have seen it. Is there anything, as the most fervent comic book person on this roster, is there anything else you wanted to add about the reaction to Wonder Woman so far?
No, it's great. I hope I enjoy it as much as everybody seems to be enjoying it, because, you know, then I get to keep punching down and have a DCEU movie that I like.
Yeah. Well, Chrissy, I assume there's going to be more writing from you about Wonder Woman beyond your review on the internet, because you are a well-employed writer about things like this movie.
Yeah, I'm pondering some stuff now. It was just really fun. And I'm just, a lot of times, I mean, you guys know this, whenever a big movie hits and you're not super fan of it, you still have to keep writing about it. It feels like a chore, but I really like this and I'm excited to keep talking about it. So I'm trying to figure out more ways to do that.
Does Wonder Woman have anything to say about life in the age of Trump?
I mean, absolutely. It absolutely does. Like, you know, I think that, you know, nevertheless, she persisted is can be a war cry for Wonder Woman.
Oh, man.
Well, there's your next article. Go get
it. I look forward to seeing that shirt with like the Wonder Woman logo on it.
Oh, it's out there.
Screenings. It's got to be. Well, Christy, I will look forward to reading more of what you have to write, as will everyone listening to this. And thank you for coming on to Womansplain Wonder Woman to us.
Thanks,
happy
Christy.
To do it. Thanks so much.
All right. Thank you, Christy. That was awesome. That does it for this week's Fighting in the War Room. We'll be back next week. And as promised, we'll talk more about Wonder Woman once some of us have seen it. Thanks again to Christy Pachko for joining us to talk about the movie. In the meantime, tell the people who you are.
Is it me?
David.
I'm up?
Yeah, it is.
Oh, hi.
Yeah.
My name is David Ehrlich. You can find me on the internet on Twitter at David Ehrlich, and also on IndieWire at The Articles I Write. And you can find all of us together on Facebook at Fighting in the War Room.
And I'm Dave Gonzalez. Spell my first name D-A-7-E. That's also my Twitter handle. And you could find my work there, including the most recent post I did, Patches. 7 fireworks shows gone horribly wrong. Thanks, Patches. And then also Storm of Spoilers, my other podcast about Game of Thrones I do with Joanna Robinson and Neil Miller, is actually back to talking about Game of Thrones. We're doing rewatches. We're on season 2 this week. It's going to be great. And you could find that and this podcast on Facebook at, you know, Fighting in the War Room and Storm of Spoilers, respectively, where you could talk to us and we could talk to you and we could give you the like button. And occasionally you could post reviews, say, like, if there's one from New Zealand we missed, but you have it archived for some reason.
I'm Katie Rich, and I always feel inspired by Dave's talking to plug my own stuff. So I'm at vanityfair.com, where I've written a thing or two recently, including about the god-awful Spider-Man poster that came out before Memorial Day. And on the podcast Little Gold Men, where we have some really fun Emmys-pegged interviews. We're talking to a lot of people on really good shows, including Claire Foy this week. I'm doing an interview with Zach Woods, who plays my favorite character on Silicon Valley, so
who I did forward to that. I'm sorry, I just got so excited that I did an Emmys thing. I was,
what'd
like,
you do?
I don't know if I should be giving away my scoops, but I had a lovely a lifelong dream fulfilled. On my way to the airport to go to Cannes, I had an interview with Lauren Graham about Gilmore Girls.
Oh, good.
So look forward to that.
I do. I look forward
sorry,
to that.
Sorry, I didn't mean to step on your toes. I just got so excited to enter the exciting world of television.
Yeah, it's a thing. Top of the Lake is on it, I hear. So I'm at vanityfair.com, and I'm also on Twitter at Katie Rich, KateyRich, and we're all on Twitter at FITWR, where we like hearing from you, and you can answer this week's lightning round question, which was...
I think if you're going to answer this week's lightning round question with a tweet, you could actually do a screenshot, because
or
the answer is... Yeah, in honor of Captain Underpants, the first epic movie, what's the best cinematic undergarment?
Oh, sound like you're going to say something else. Best cinematic undergarment. Thank you for listening, and we'll be back talking to you next week.